This is an iHeart podcast.
You want smart political talk without the meltdowns? We got you.
And I'm Carol Markowitz.
And I'm Mary Catherine Hamm. We've been around the block in media, and we're doing things differently.
Normally is about real conversations. Thoughtful, try to be funny, grounded, and no panic.
We'll keep you informed and entertained without ruining your day.
Join us every Tuesday and Thursday.
Normally, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On the Jordan Harbinger Show, you'll hear amazing stories from people that have lived them, from spies to CEOs, even an undercover agent who infiltrated the Gambino crime family. You're about to hear a preview of the Jordan Harbinger Show with Jack Garcia, who did just that.
My career was 24 out of 26 years was solely dedicated working undercover. I walk in, I'm in the bar. Now, there's a barmaid there, good-looking young lady. She's serving me a drink. Hey, what would you like? I usually, my drink was, give me a Kettle One martini, three olives, glass of water on the side. I finish the drink. The guys come in. I'm going to go in my pocket, take out the big wad of money. Bam, I give her $100. If you're with the mob, I say, hey, Jordan, you're on record with us. That means we protect you. Nobody could shake you down. We could shake you down, but you're on record with us.
For more on how Jack became so trusted in the highest levels of the Gambino organization, check out episode 392 of The Jordan Harbinger Show.
The military matters a lot. And look, we're going to do a big special tonight. So we're going to talk about Iran and North Korea and Russia and China, and we're going to really talk a lot about our enemies. But before we get to that, let's talk about our military. Because when I say things like the military matters a lot, I'm actually not doing that bread and butter Americana support our troops type thing. I'm not saying that. I'm saying when you're a wealthy nation, you make enemies. When you're a powerful nation, you make enemies. We have a lot of enemies in this world. We have a lot of people who would love nothing more than to see the great American experiment come crashing down. Well, why haven't they done anything about it? It's not as if this world is all of a sudden lacking tyrants who want to take over a place or kill people. The world has never lacked those types of people. They never will lack those types of people. Why haven't they done it? Well, because we have a military who will kill you if you try. That's the truth. And you know, you well know, I'm not invade everywhere, Jesse. That's not me. Bit of a non-interventionist. But the only reason the wolves have been held at bay, it's because of our military. Our military matters a lot. And our military has gone through a horrible, horrible transition in recent years. And they are rotting out from underneath us. And people don't know about it. Oh, don't get me wrong. All my buddies who are still in, they talk to me about it all the time. They complain. They get out. They're telling their sons not to join. It's that bad. But what do I tell you about communists and communism? Communists, they don't look at anything, anything, and say to themselves, just leave that alone. That's not how they think. Communism, one of the basic tenets of communism is it must be for everybody. It must be universal. It has to be worldwide. And that is one of the reasons we lost this culture, as we have never understood that. We have never fought like they're going to take it all. We always thought, well, I'll have my church. How's that working out for you? Oh, at least we have the Cub Scouts. Oops, no, you didn't. Well, we have corporations. I mean, these are rich guys. They're not gonna go to their side. How'd that work? And we always hung on to the military, didn't we? Hard work, meritocracy, discipline. These are obviously Republican values. That's never gonna go their way. Oh yeah, it did. Oh yeah, it did. You remember that communist they busted at West Point a couple years ago? Do you think he was the only one? Or was he the only one stupid enough to put a picture of it on social media? Don't fool yourself. We are in bad, bad trouble right now. And I don't know why I see so much surprise about this from people on the right. They'll even try to deny it. Are you trying to be against our troops? They're not going to do that. Of course they are. These people are communists. What communist nation have you ever known that didn't have ideological purity tests within its military? They all do. It's basic stuff. They're not going to let the enforcement arm go off half-cocked thinking about, you know, things that aren't approved. That's not how they work. That's not how they work at all. You see this headline from Reuters a couple days ago? Quote, Pentagon, stumped by extremism in the ranks, orders stand down in the next 60 days. And that was, if you dig further into it, they're going to dig into things like white nationalism, extremism. Let me ask you something. These people are all leftists now, all of them. All of them gone through the American education system, all good little commies now. Let's talk about you for a moment. What are your beliefs? And which of your beliefs do you think they would say are extreme? If you think life begins at conception, you've seen who these people are, you've seen how they talk. Do you think they would view that as being extreme? Or let's go with a basic view. Maybe you're a Christian or a traditional Jew or a traditional Muslim or something. Do you believe that marriage is between a man and a woman? You're free to believe whatever you want, but do you believe that? Do you think they think that's extreme and hateful and bigoted? What about the Second Amendment? What do you think about the Second Amendment? Do you know that we know for a fact, because they talked about it extensively, the Second Amendment has nothing to do with hunting. It's not even really about home protection from a burglar breaking in. Now, those are nice benefits of it. The Second Amendment is if the United States of America's government becomes despotic, it's so you can protect yourself against it. Do you think they consider that to be an extreme view? I got word today as they're looking through how they're going to enforce these policies, what these policies mean. One of their things is going to be that stupid Pepe the Frog thing people use on social media. It became a symbol of Trump fans. They would put some frog up there. There was some online forum joke. Well, they're going to be combing through the social media pages of the military to see if there's any frog pictures up there. Might be extremist. And I'm not just talking about Democrats versus Republicans. I'm talking about an ideological rot that has worked its way through our entire military now. It's really, really, really bad. Which, that's one thing in peacetime. I mean, okay, it's not ideal right now. Peacetime doesn't last forever. And your enemies, the people you compete against, they're not always going to be a tiny ragtag country you can slap around with very little effort at all. You realize that, right? The history of the world says that's not the case. And when the wolves come, if you're not ready for them, you're in very, very deep trouble. And right now, we're not ready for them. I told you this story before. I have a guy high up in the United States Navy, and he said, all those great commanders from World War II, all the legends you know, all the names you would know, he said, not one of those guys would make it past LT today. You want an example? A, remember that destroyer, CO, the head of the destroyer? His men do a mission. They capture an AK-47 on the mission. Mission accomplished. Good job, boys. He has a plaque made of it. Oh, it's a good thing, right? Woohoo! We did it! He got demoted. Kicked off. Goodbye. You see, celebration of success gets you kicked off. Do you remember this disgraceful scene while Joe Biden was vice president during Obama's presidency where Iran had our men and women on their knees, hands on their heads? Do you remember that? That's Iran. Iran had us on our knees. What does that look like after 10, 20 more years of this social justice warrior rot destroying our military? It is a big deal. And then, so we're going to talk about all these countries tonight, right? China, North Korea, Iran, Russia. Do you think China, North Korea, Iran or Russia, do you think any of them are doing social justice warrior thing in their ranks? Or do you think they're spending every single minute of every single day figuring out new and inventive ways to kill you? I know what they're doing. All that may have made you uncomfortable, but I'm right. And we're going to talk about those evil empires next. And rest assured, we do talk about evil on this show. These countries are evil, oppressive, horrible places that will do horrible things to whoever they conquer. We had better be ready. Let's talk about what we're facing tonight. Hang on. Well, it's a dangerous world out there, and no, I don't just mean crossing the street on a major highway. There are nuclear weapons in the world, and I think we forget about that sometimes, and some countries who really hate our guts have them. Here's a list, in case you don't know, of the countries who have nukes. Us, obviously. Sorry about that, Japan. UK, France, Israel, Pakistan, Russia, India, China, and North Korea. And I want to focus on a couple of those countries now with Frances Martel. She's the Breitbart International News Editor at Breitbart News. Frances, China, let's start there. What's their nuclear arsenal look like compared to ours?
Like everybody else's, it's pretty tiny compared to ours, but you know, anytime an enemy has more than one, that's a problem. We do believe that they're somewhere in the thousands. They're trying to keep it secretive, and we do know that they're trying to update the arsenal, but that it isn't as modern as what we have.
Okay, and forgive me, I'm very naive. I went to community college. Does everyone who has these nuclear weapons, they can reach anywhere in the world with them? They all have to be launched from subs, satellites, they press a button on the ground. How does this work?
Well, you need to have, you know, you have the warhead, which is the actual nuke, and then you have to have a transportation device. So not everybody has, you know, an intercontinental ballistic missile where they could go across the Pacific and bomb us. I think that was a big concern with North Korea constantly threatening that they had one, and then suddenly retreating and threatening to bomb Guam instead of bombing Los Angeles. And that was kind of a hint like, okay, maybe they don't have the capabilities. But this is obviously a big issue. I think of all the countries that we talk about as our enemies who have nuclear weapons, China obviously has the most ability to probably reach something that is significantly within U.S. territory.
Where does North Korea's technology lie when it comes to this? Look, I am as guilty as anyone else of making fun of North Korea every time they flutter one into the South China Sea, but I'm assuming they're only getting better and not getting worse. How much better are they?
They're a little better. The last thing they debuted was a submarine powered missile. So something that could hit, you know, an important military asset of ours in the Pacific, but not something quite yet that could hit, say, you know, Washington or New York or Los Angeles. We know that they've attempted to detonate bombs that they claim are hydrogen bombs, but the seismic impact of the nuclear tests isn't big enough to really confirm that that's what it was. It could have been, you know, a sort of a more conventional atomic weapon plus more dynamite to make it look bigger. But we're not totally sure what it is, but we know that it's slightly less than what they say, and yet enough to really concern us because we have important assets all over the world.
Frances, staying on North Korea for just a brief moment, if you'll allow me, how is their military? I understand it's not anywhere equal to ours, but I have a hard time believing they have the funds to supply an extremely modern military. At the same time, I don't want to, you know, undersell my opponent. What are they?
Well, an interesting thing is if you would have asked me this question 4 years ago, we would have been having a totally different conversation. Since President Trump advanced the multilateral sanctions on North Korea in 2017, which, by the way, he got China to agree to sanction North Korea, which is mind-blowing, they really don't have the money for this. I mean, they haven't had a nuclear test since 2017. They're mostly using their military right now to keep the border shut because they're terrified of a coronavirus outbreak. They have no money to, you know, construct hospitals that they started building during the pandemic. And they were just hit by a severe flood wave last summer, so they have no food. The only real advantage they have is that North Korea has very complex territory. They have these horrible cold mountains that are very difficult to navigate, and that's their home turf. So they have at least an advantage on difficult terrain. But in terms of training, assets, equipment, they are severely underfunded.
Good. Now, you mentioned China sanctioning North Korea. I've always found this relationship to be fascinating. What is it? Are they friends, cousins? Is it a big brother, little brother? Does North Korea do what they're told? Are they belligerent and do whatever they want?
It's interesting. So I think it's a relationship where they regret kind of getting into this relationship, where they sort of regret that generations ago they made this pact. Technically, China and North Korea are still at war with us and with the South Koreans. The Korean War never ended. So the real title is that they're nominal allies in a war. But Kim Jong-un has made very clear that he considers himself the supreme leader of North Korea, and he doesn't think anybody's his boss. Xi Jinping has shown, you know, sort of an exhaustion with dealing with Kim Jong-un to the point that he agreed to those sanctions. And if you read their state media going back and forth, North Korea referred to China as a puppet of the United States at one point when they agreed to the sanctions. It's not a friendly relationship, but at this point they have no choice. It's been 70 years that they've been in the same war together.
Okay, what is the North Korean economy? How do they make any money at all?
Most of it is illicit trade, a lot of it across the Yalu River, which is the border with China. So it's all very localized trade where you have people taking North Korean seafood, North Korean coal, and trying to sell it in China. And then you have Chinese traders trying to make money just bringing in food and necessary assets. At this point, the North Korean economy is almost non-existent because North Korea totally shut down its border, China shut down its border, and they're both afraid of giving each other coronavirus. So it's very dire by all accounts, but normally what we would have is a lot of illicit trade.
Okay. Well, there were all these rumors. I remember them very well. What, 6 months ago, a year ago, Kim Jong-un was dead. Kim Jong-un was almost dead. And then all that just kind of went away. Is this guy dead?
No, we have no reason to believe he's dead. Every few months he dies. And there are sort of competing theories about why this is, right? Either it's counterintelligence meant to confuse us, either it's Kim Jong-un himself faking his death to see who under him would be happy if he died and then purging those people. We have theories that, you know, the last time we thought he was dead, there was a theory that he just had coronavirus, and we know that he's obese and he's a smoker, he has comorbidities. So it's possible that he was extremely sick. But these are all rumors. They all come through either anonymous sources or diplomats within the North Korean state that are trying to fight a little bit against their own regime. And it's so difficult to call anything about it anything but gossip.
Okay. Now, lastly, my favorite subject, a place that fascinates me, Russia. What is Russia militarily? Are they a juggernaut still? I obviously know they have plenty of nuclear weapons. I know their space program is pretty advanced. What are they militarily?
Well, I mean, I think we can judge them by the enemies they choose, and they've chosen to invade Georgia and Ukraine. So those are the countries that they feel like they are on par with militarily. I think an army like the People's Liberation Army in China could easily defeat the Russian military. The Indian military just beat China on their border, so I'm sure they could take out the Russians. This is, like, if I was a middle-level country in terms of military size, again, like Ukraine, like Georgia, this is a juggernaut. If I'm China, the United States, India, Pakistan, basically any other nuclear state, I'm not worried.
Okay, now, what about European nations? How well, basically I'm trying to gauge how much can we rely on them if Russia does act up? Where's Britain these days? France?
Well, the European Union is pretty quiet about this sort of thing. Once in a while, they give a human rights award to some poor dissident that Putin has abused for a few years. But we can't rely on them because economically, Russia has a bit of a stranglehold with all its its natural resources. It's got oil, it's got natural gas. It's constantly trying to sell cheaper, warming fuels to Europe, and Europe is interested. And this is something that came up at the last couple of NATO meetings, right, with President Trump. He came up and he said, "You're accusing me of being friendly to Putin, but you're actually doing business and enriching the guy." And it's clearly a national security threat to all of the NATO countries when you have, the security of the country at risk, because if Russia just decides not to sell natural gas to, half of these EU countries, then you have a serious problem.
Frances Martel, you will be back soon. Thank you so much, ma'am. That was awesome.
Thank you.
We'll be back. All eyes are on the Biden's administration approach to China, how they're going to handle China, how they're going to handle trade with China, military with China, because look, it's the history there is really ugly. The media can try to suppress that all they want. The Biden family's history with China is not great. Jen Psaki's being asked about it.
We're starting from an approach of patience as it relates to our relationship with China. So that means we're going to have consultations with our allies, we're going to have consultations with Democrats and Republicans, and we're going to allow the interagency process to work its way through to review and assess how we should move forward with our relationship.
Those are a bunch of words that don't really say anything, don't mean anything to me. So we figured we'd bring in an expert and figure out exactly what's what over there and what we need to do. So joining me now is Weifeng Zhang. He's the Senior Research Fellow with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. That means he's a lot smarter than all of us. Weifeng, explain to me what we're expecting out of the Biden administration. Is it just going to be more of the same, but they'll talk nicer?
Thanks for having me, Jesse. So I think the big challenge now facing U.S. policymakers is we need to move from China Policy 1.0 to China Policy 2.0, meaning that during the Trump administration, American policymakers are now increasingly aware that China not only presents economic opportunities, it also presents national security threats or national security concerns. Now we are pretty clear about that, but moving into the Biden administration, now the challenge is how to balance these two considerations, because we do still want to trade with China because economic opportunities are there, but we don't want to compromise our national securities. So this is why striking a balance is very complicated, and words like what you just shown doesn't mean a lot, because we need to get down to the details, and there are many details when it comes to national security threats and how to still preserve a trade relations in a way that's safe, so to speak.
Weifeng, how do we, because I understand international relations are complicated. They're messy. They always are. Diplomacy is just naturally messy. You're doing diplomacy with your enemies lots of the time. China, they're our enemy. They consider us to be the enemy. But you're right. We do have some trade with them. How do we balance that? What is the appropriate balance? Okay, so we're exchanging goods, but we hate each other?
So I think what we need to, the balance we need to strike here is that we need to move away from what the U.S. has been doing for over two decades, which is to just conduct romantic trade relations after China joined the WTO. Now, there are a lot of security concerns when it comes to, in the economic relations with China, and I think technology is the most important one. Now, at this moment, I want to bring in the issue with Taiwan here, because it presents where technological challenge is between U.S. and China. Because as we have seen in the past 2 weeks, right, there are intense military activities over the Taiwan Strait. And the reason that's in the news is because Taiwan is the industry leader when it comes to semiconductor manufacturing. And China is trying to catch up with the U.S. and the rest of the industrial world in terms of manufacturing semiconductor chips. And Taiwan is the absolute leader in that sense. And this is why Taiwan has been of such great interest in terms of a U.S.-China competition. And defending the security of semiconductor industry is of a great interest to the U.S. So this is the kind of the nuance that U.S. policymakers have to pay attention to. It's not just whether to trade or not, because we know that we need to maintain the trade relations. So the question is how, in a way that's sophisticated and safe.
Wei Feng, will you please explain what a semiconductor is for those of us who went to community college?
Absolutely. So semiconductor chips is like the brain for computers and electronic device. And the thing about semiconductor chips is that we want, or we always want it to be, for the parts to be small. The smaller, the better. And Taiwan has the highest capacity in the world to be able to manufacture very small chips. And China is playing very hard in catching up because China's semiconductor chips has been, you know, their parts are much bigger according to the industry standard. And so the Taiwan semiconductor manufacturing company, or TSMC, it's the absolute industry leader because they are leading even Intel and Samsung in South Korea, because they can produce very small chips. And that's of great value, because the smaller is always the better when it comes to electronic devices.
Wei Feng, one of the things that really struck me about the Cold War, if you look back on things like that, was we Americans, obviously for understandable reasons, look at things through the American perspective. But if you talk to the Soviet guys, the big shot Soviet guys throughout there, they were always worried about us. They thought we were the big bad bully, and they thought they were the innocent ones. How worried is China about us? We always worry about them. How worried are they about us?
That's absolutely, it's a great point you bring up, because it's exactly the same in China too. Because from the Chinese government's perspective, they are no longer as interested in European Union, for example. They are now still much more interested in understanding the U.S., because they view the U.S. as the greatest obstacle to the path toward achieving the Chinese dream of rejuvenization of their nation. And that's precisely the policy under President Xi Jinping and his predecessors. For a few years now, I've been running a research program called the Policy Change Index, where we try to read between the lines of Chinese propaganda from what they're saying to understand their behavior. And one of the major policy initiatives under the current and two previous Chinese presidents is to become a world leader, the leader on the global stage. And the U.S. is obviously in between where China now and achieving their goal toward a global leader.
Is that the only reason they view us as an obstacle, is because we happen to be above them at the time?
Above them, and also we hold very different values, right? So when it comes to, you know, freedom and democracy, which is values that the Chinese do not hold, and that presents a conflict, because from the Chinese perspective, if the U.S. holds a different value and the U.S. is ahead of China, then it's a problem, right? It's hard to justify to the Chinese people why we still hold values different from the U.S. values, because we are behind, right? And so the U.S. is ahead of us. And so this is precisely why events like January 6th on the Capitol Hill is, to the Chinese, from the Chinese perspective, an advantage to them, because that's where they can hold against us and say, see, democracy sometimes doesn't work. Maybe our values is not that bad. So I think the values is, besides what the fact that we are economically more advanced than China, the values we hold that are different from Chinese values is also the reasons why they view us very differently as an adversary.
We obviously don't know a ton about what the individual citizen in China believes or wants, because they are so censored and controlled over there. But we always pretend like they want to be us. People stuck in these crappy regimes want to be American. Is that the case? Is that? Do they look at us? Do we have any indication that their citizenry looks at us and thinks, man, that would be way better than this?
Well, at the individual level, perhaps that's true. Because what I can say is that I was born and raised in China before I came to America well over a decade ago. And when I was growing up there, you know, people like me, the place we looked up to is the outside world. What is outside of China, and the United States is, an example of where the free world is. And so, at the individual level, I believe the Chinese people, they do know that the U.S. is more advanced. For example, you know, vaccines, COVID-19 vaccines, Chinese people, they are aware that the vaccines produced by the Americans are, you know, at least more effective and safer than vaccine produced by China. But what the Chinese people think at a policy level is less relevant, in my opinion, than what the Chinese policymakers or Chinese government thinks. And this is why we emphasize so much on what Chinese policymakers are thinking when it comes to the U.S., because that matters a lot to what they would do on the global stage. And that matters a lot to how the U.S. should respond to them.
Wei Feng Zhang, that was friggin' awesome. Thank you, man. I appreciate you.
Thank you for having me, Jesse.
I love getting smarter. I have a long way to go. A long way to go. All right, we'll be back. North Korea and Iran always make me nervous because they're wild cards. They're complete wild cards, and I don't know what's going on in there, and I'm glad we're about to have somebody on that knows what's going on in there, because I hear Anthony Blinken, our Secretary of State, say this, quote, based on public reports, the time that it would take Iran to produce enough fissile material for a nuclear weapon is down to, we think, a few months? That doesn't sound good. Joining me now to talk about that and other things is Lieutenant Colonel James J. Carafano. He's the Vice President for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Colonel, Iran with a nuclear weapon? Do they, what? That doesn't sound good.
Yeah, probably because it's not a really good idea. And people think, oh no, the mullahs with a nuclear weapon, you know. But the reality is the real significant danger of a nuclear Iran is that no Arab nation in the region would sit by and watch itself be intimidated by a nuclear Iran. So almost predictably, Saudi Arabia and most likely Turkey and Egypt would immediately produce nuclear programs to match against Iran and Iranian influence. So literally overnight, you would have upwards of, what, five nuclear powers in the region? And, you know, literally that's like throwing, you know, a matchstick in, you know, throwing, you know, fire on the gasoline. Or gasoline on the fire. It's just, it's not a healthy situation. You know, I would laugh to hear Blinken say, oh my God, they're months away from being able to produce a nuclear weapon. And what he means by that is Iran moved to 20% nuclear enrichment, which by the way is a violation of the Iran deal. That gets you about 90% of the way to producing fissile material for a bomb. So literally they're a snap away from having building material for a bomb, and then they've always had bomb plans, and they could manufacture a bomb, and then they already have the missiles. So the irony of this is, you hear Blinken warn about this. This is largely because of the Iran deal, which the Obama administration, which Blinken was a part of, put in place. Because what this demonstrates, if they could so quickly and easily get to the point that they can make a bomb, that's because the Iran deal, which by the way they are still a party to, was never a real obstacle to them in the first place, which shows that when the Obama team said we have a deal that keeps them from getting a bomb, they were lying to us. And now we've brought back all the people that negotiated that deal and put them in charge.
I get people that ask me this all the time, because I have a bunch of friends from Israel, have family in Israel, and they ask things like, why don't we stop them? Well, that's such a simplistic question. Can we stop them? Could we stop them from doing this in some way if we wanted to?
Well, if you mean, you know, stop them militarily, it would be difficult to do that without literally having an all-out war. You would have to physically attack multiple sites. You would probably have to attack them many times, And it's a level of offensive operations that the Iranians just couldn't stand there and take it. They would have to declare war on somebody, if not the United States, on neighbors in the region. So you would trigger a regional war, and then you're on balance, should we trigger a regional war or not? But people misjudge. Look, people talk about the Iranian nuclear program like it's some kind of conveyor belt, and that what we do starts or stops them on that conveyor belt. That is completely untrue. Iran could have a nuclear weapon anytime they wanted. Before the Iran deal, during the Iran deal, after the Iran deal, Iran always has the flexibility, even with all the sanctions, to choose when they become a nuclear power. What you can do is influence that decision. You know, North Korea became a nuclear power. We could have physically stopped them by destroying North Korea, but we created the political conditions that we just said, if you do it, it's not going to be the end of the world. What the Trump administration was doing, it was not us physically preventing them from building a bomb. It was all the external pressures that we put on them, which sent the signal that, dude, you are an idiot if you decide to go nuclear now. And taking all that pressure off, that is going to lead to a bomb being built. And once they build it, we're not going to go to war to stop it. That's just a fact.
Okay, setting aside the nuclear part of it, and believe me, everybody knows I don't want to go to war with Iran or anything like that, but I am curious, what is their level of military capability, military sophistication? It's easy for people in America. I do expect people in America to be an expert on every Middle Eastern country, but it's easy for everyone in America to think they're, you know, riding horses around over there and shooting muskets. It's obviously not the case. But where are they, Colonel? Are they really advanced? Not very advanced? Where are they?
It's one of these kind of good news, bad news things. You know, it's like you're in a ring with a prize fighter who had an incredibly solid first punch. And if you could last to the second or third round, the guy would drop from exhaustion. You could kick the butt at him, but you'd have to worry about getting hit with that first punch to begin with. So because of what we did the last 4 years, we have put a lot of pressure on Iran. We have, you know, weakened their surrogates. We've deprived them of lots of money. It really has, they've got internal dissension they have to worry about. It really has impacted on their military readiness and military capability. On the other hand, they have some very sophisticated capabilities in cyber, drones, and missiles, so that they can pack a pretty good first punch. So in other words, if you had a war with Iran, you could, over the long term, mitigate their ability to do offensive things. But on the other hand, in the short term, they can do some pretty damaging things. As we saw, for example, when they did that attack last year on Saudi Arabia with drones and missiles. Very sophisticated attack, very destructive, very damaging. Now, they couldn't do that forever, and we could take out that offensive capability with an aggressive campaign. So you can mitigate the offensive threat. But on the other hand, nobody wants to invade Iran and try to take over and fix that country. That's just an absolute quagmire, and nobody's going to do that. So the trick is, what you want to do is to make the Iranians risk averse, to make them worry that if they escalate what they're doing, that they could put their own regime in jeopardy. That was exactly the policy of the Trump administration, and I think it was actually working incredibly well. Part of the reason why the Arab-Israeli normalization made such rapid progress was because the Arab regimes recognized that we had their back. You know, we weren't putting tens of thousands of troops in the country. We weren't threatening war, but we had their back. And they saw the advantage of normalizing relations with Israel, coming together in collective defense, holding off a bulwark against the Iranians, and really, I think, containing that threat. It was exactly the right strategy, and we leave it at our own peril. And my great concern, look, I wish the Biden team well. Everybody wants them to make America more safe, but to go back to the Obama policy of trying to figure out how we can accommodate Iran is really unleashing them on the region, and it's a huge mistake. And to your point about North Korea, these problems are inextricably linked. Because if we give a sweetheart deal to Iran, who is acting more aggressive, more difficult, violating more rules, then the North Koreans are going to say, well, if they get a sweetheart deal by being more aggressive, we're going to be more aggressive and we'll get a sweetheart deal too. So by rushing back to the Iran deal and rushing trying to accommodate the Iranians, the Biden administration very easily could actually also trigger a crisis in North Korea, and they could be facing two crises in two theaters simultaneously.
Colonel, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you.
Yeah. Sorry I couldn't make you happy there, my friend. Next time, maybe.
No, I appreciate the info. You made us smarter. That's what's important.
See you. Thanks.
Thank you. All right. We're not done yet. Hang on. It's easy to lose sight of the fact that you're blessed and I'm blessed for being in America. But didn't all that bring it home when you talk about how terrible these places are? The things they do to their own people, the things they'll do to us? It's good here. Let's keep it that way, huh? And let's take a minute, because we don't do that a lot. We don't do a bunch of sappy things on this show, but why don't we take a minute and think about the people stuck living there? Imagine what it's like right now in North Korea. Those are real people, flesh and blood, just like you and I. And let's also realize we as Americans, no, we don't have some obligation to invade and take over all these places, but we do have an obligation to ourselves to make sure we are always strong enough, always ready enough to take them on, and always being willing to take them on. You see, that's the biggest problem with what we're facing right now with the Biden administration is not only is it looking unwilling to take them on, he looks like he wants to help them along. That's the problem. That is the big problem. China is going to be a problem. Russia is not going away. They're not nothing. Iran, even, closer and closer to a nuclear weapon. You heard what we said. It's ugly out there. North Korea already has them. North Korea. Dangerous world out there. We will stay on top of it. We will keep you informed. I'll see you. Newton Group Transfer. They are here to help you if you're stuck in a timeshare. These stories from people who have these timeshares and can't get out of them, they're shocking. These timeshare companies, not all of them, but so many, they get their hooks into you and you can't give them up. You can't give them up. Or they'll do things like they charge you thousands of dollars. One girl, she got past her timeshare when her mother passed away. She gets past the timeshare, doesn't want the timeshare, doesn't use the timeshare. They tell her she can get out of it. For $4,000, she has to come up with a $4,000 check. This is not right. It's unjust. And Newton Group Transfers is here to help you. If you are in a timeshare and want out or know someone who is, call 888-845-3773. That's 888-84-JESSE or go to timesharejesse.com. Newton Group Transfer. They will help you out.
You want smart political talk without the meltdowns? We got you.
And I'm Carol Markowitz.
And I'm Mary Catherine Hamm. We've been around the block in media and we're doing things differently.
Normally is about real conversations, thoughtful, try to be funny, grounded, and no panic.
We'll keep you informed and entertained without ruining your day.
Join us every Tuesday and Thursday.
Normally on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is an iHeart podcast.